Lizzie's kissing men like a long walk home when the music stops.
I'm Emma.
I'm Kiana.
I'm Tanasia.
I'm Lila.
And I'm Badila. And
we're the Perfect 10 After School. And we love to be part of WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. Celebrating creative community radio for Greens and Columbia counties.
Yay!
Oh, hello, hello.
Music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to stars and stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeple. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
WGXC. What shows you up? Which programmers do you connect to? Call us at 518-622-2598 extension 4 and leave us a message. Or email us at feedback@wgxc.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Ezra of Jackson Heights, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Ever since songwriters started writing songs, they have written songs about a rose.
About a rose.
Red roses, blue roses, old roses, new roses. Roses from the south and east and west. But here's the rose song that I love the best.
The best.
Show me a rose, I'll show you a girl who cares. Show me a rose, or leave me alone. Show me a rose, I'll show you a stag at bay. Show me a rose, or leave me alone. She taught me how to do the tango, down where the palm trees sway. I called her Rosa Mia, and she called a spade a spade. Show me a rose, I'll show you a storm at sea. Show me a rose, leave me alone. One night in Bixby, Mississippi, we watched the clouds roll by. I said, my dear, how are you? And she whispered, so am I. Show me a rose, I'll show you a girl named Sam. Show me a rose, or leave me alone.
Show me a rose.
Show me a rose.
A fragrant rose.
A fragrant rose. Make believe that you don't know me until you show me a rose.
A fragrant rose.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Gregory Forte's Radio Museum, where we celebrate voices from radio's past. I'm going to play you a 2013 recording of Mr. Joe Frank. Joe Frank was an overnight radio personality, told great stories, and tonight's going to be a 20-minute excerpt of something that originally aired at like 2 o'clock in the morning. We're also going to hear a recipe, so grab a pencil. Thanks for tuning in to the Radio Museum at WGXC here at ACRA 90.7. Thank you. So, as promised, I'm going to play you a little Joe Frank. This is a 30-minute excerpt from a longer show. It's called Somewhere Out There. Let's enjoy it together, and I'll see you on the other side for some more music and a recipe. So gather a pen that works. You've got Pasta Vizzul coming after about 30 minutes of Joe Frank.
Situation. It's hard to get angry and laugh at the same time. I must add an ounce of love to everything I do. I must have a forgiving view of events and people. I must have an optimistic view of the world. I must believe that most people are doing the best that they can. Instead of blowing up when someone says something unkind, I should take a moment to rethink the situation. If I can tell myself that the person is probably having a bad day, I mean, we all have our bad days, then there's a good chance I won't get angry. I must understand that a conflict is not a win-lose situation. It's not important who wins or who's right. The goal is to solve a mutual problem through good communication. I must not expect to be treated with fairness and consideration at all times. I must take a few minutes to relax my whole body. I'll shake my shoulders, inhale and exhale deeply a few times, and clear my head of thoughts and concerns. I know what I'll do. The next time I find pressure mounting, I'll take 10 minutes and go for a brisk walk or climb some stairs. Then, when I return to the problem, I'll feel like a new person.
What is death? If I put the barrel of a gun against my forehead and pull the trigger, what will happen? Where will I go? I wonder if expressions we have come casually to use when referring to death actually reflect reality. For example, the term, bought the farm. Could it be that when I die, I will actually come into possession of a farm I purchased with my own money? Is it possible? I bought the farm. I have acres of rolling meadows dotted with clover where sheep and cattle graze. Fields of wheat heavy with grain appear like a great amber ocean, undulating in the wind. I move into a white clapboard house with a shingled roof. The green shuttered windows have parted chintz curtains. Beside the house is a great ancient oak tree, its roots gnarled and twisted. From one of its thick old branches, hanging by a braided rope, is a rubber tire in which many a delighted child has swung up to the sky and back again. Inside my farmhouse, there's a living room with an ancient Emerson radio. The furniture has slipcovers with paisley print, and there's a hooked rug on the oak-planked floor. The fireplace mantel bears a set of family photographs, old daguerreotypes in oval cameo frames. Next to the fireplace are a pair of tongs, a set of bellows, a fire prod, and a pile of neatly split logs. On the second floor of the bedroom, there's an old four-poster bed, the cover a patchwork quilt, the pillows overstuffed with goose down. Next to the bed is a night table with an evening prayer book and a single candlestick. In the hall at the top of the stairs, there's a trap door in the ceiling. When I pull the string that dangles from it, a ladder comes down, leading me up to the musty attic, where grimy light through a single crusted window plays on ancient trunks, bales of old letters held together with faded ribbons, and a card table with three legs. And in the dining room downstairs, farmhands sit at a long trestle table, drinking cups of steaming coffee with double thick cream, eating a big country breakfast. Sunny side and scrambled eggs, crisp bacon, sizzling juicy sausages, pork chops, corned beef hash, sourdough biscuits, hush puppies and cornbread, a great bubbling warm jug of maple syrup next to a pile of pancakes browned at the edges, fragrant thick slices of French toast sprinkled with cinnamon and sugar, bowls of oatmeal and farina topped with cream, melted butter and molasses, vials of insulin, Dilantin, and small bottles of oxygen being administered by paramedics to farm workers as they deliriously push themselves away from the table and stagger toward the door, each blood-thinning agent, anticoagulant, seizure control medication being injected by a hypodermic needle. The farmhands and red-cheeked farm girls operate the machinery, sluice out the pigsties, repair the fences, seed the corn, and milk the cows who move leisurely among the clover, gather around the salt cowlick, the lowing of their voices and the gentle tinkling of the bells around their necks heard at a great distance. Around evening time, a long, leisurely line of cows, their tails swinging, makes its way heavily toward the barn, the females to be milked, the bulls to stomp irritably in their stalls. And the barn is a huge two-story wood frame structure. There's a wooden ladder, some of the rungs missing, leading up to the loft where a pitchfork can be seen embedded in one of the many wire-bound bales of alfalfa and hay. The air is fragrant. The sun shines through in shafts at oblique angles, creating warm pools of light on the floor. I can see chemical fertilizers, Grow Swift, MaxiGerm, Proliferam. The pigsty, nearby, is a penned-in muddy area about 20 feet by 30 feet. At the end of it is a trough filled with slop, usually kitchen refuse, and corn husks. The farmhands live nearby in small single-story dirt floor shacks with two sets of double bunk beds and an old Franklin stove. The hoedown, or hootenanny, is a celebration that takes place in the barn, where one of the elders, holding a jug of corn liquor in one hand, calls the square dance. The farmhands wear blue overalls and checked shirts with bandanas around their necks, the girls in gingham dresses, black stockings, high button shoes, some in bonnets, others with cloth tied around their hair. They dance the Virginia reel exuberantly on the floor of the barn. And so, there I am. I've bought the farm, and it all seems so idyllic. A heavenly reward. The only problem is that I borrowed a lot of money from the bank for seed, livestock, and machinery. And now I owe thousands of dollars to the First National Trust. My monthly payments exceed my income. I'm borrowing from friends and church members. Finally, I put on a yard sale in which I sell family heirlooms to strangers, the ancient hand-carved armoire brought from the old country on the back of my grandfather, sepia-tinted Civil War portraits of long-dead ancestors, the cut crystal chandelier from the entrance hallway. And unable to make my mortgage payments, I am facing foreclosure. My entire farm is about to be razed for a new shopping mall. My family, having barricaded itself, having pushed furniture up against the doors, boarded the windows from the inside, awaits the sheriff. He arrives, saying, "I'm sorry, I hate to have to be the one to do this," and hammers a writ of foreclosure on the door. I come out and stand on the front porch with a shotgun in my hands, an old double-barreled rusted-out Remington with a rotten wooden stock. I'm still wearing my long johns. The foreman, standing behind the sheriff, has a bored look. He's taken his hard hat off, and his long hair in a ponytail hangs down his back. He's got a hand on one hip, and in the other, he's holding a clipboard and looking over my shoulder, distractedly taking the dimensions of my house, and eyeing my mother, who's huddled behind me. "Look, I have my orders," the foreman says. "If you need a few minutes to get your stuff together, go right ahead. But by noon, I've got to have this thing," he gestures at my house, "out of the way. So put that gun down, because it's not going to do you any good. This is progress. Even if you want to, you can't stand in its way. No matter what you say or do, it's like shouting against the fall of night. Forget it. Give in. It'll be a nice mall. Maybe your mother would like a job. There are some sales positions open at Laura Ashley." Behind the foreman is a three-story tall bulldozer, a huge home-wrecking ball suspended from the end of a giant crane, and behind that, a set of road-grading machinery, cement mixers, flatbed trucks with construction crews and hard hats with riveting machinery and walkie-talkies. And three deputies with sledgehammers and a battering ram bash their way through my barricaded front door. Then the heavy machinery comes through and levels the house and the barn, and my entire farm is overrun in a matter of an hour and a half. And within a week, a new shopping mall has been built, a huge two-story atrium-centered gleaming marble and stainless steel structure with huge vaulted archways, waterfalls, and interior gardens, a giant clear glass dome over the top. A small jazz combo plays at one end and a string quartet at the other. A man in cutaway and tails, white tie and spats, sits at a piano on the second level, near where a miniature railroad train takes children squealing and laughing around a small circuit, while shoppers ride scenic elevators that move on vertical monorails. And having been dispossessed, and having lost my farm, I find myself driving to California in a 1932 pickup truck, because I've learned that California is the land of golden opportunity, a Garden of Eden, a paradise where I can get a job picking oranges. But I am somewhat incredulous and perturbed by the fact that I thought I had bought the farm, and now I've lost the farm, and I don't know if I'm living or dead. Line in the supermarket, and some jackass at the checkout counter pulls out her checkbook. Yes, her checkbook, because most of these clowns are women. And what's their problem? These people who are so selfish they're willing to hold all of us up because it's just more convenient for them. And these women who write out checks in supermarkets usually rummage through their bags for a few minutes before they can even find their checkbook. And when they do, they're rarely considerate enough to write out the name of the market and sign at the bottom of the check before the cash register brings up the total. And so while everyone waits, the cashier has to copy down their driver's license number and take down their home and work numbers, and there's some other business they have to go through until finally they walk out with their bag of groceries. And while I wait behind one of these women from hell, I sometimes feel I'm about to explode and scream, "Why don't you pay with cash, you miserable swine? Do you realize there are 5 people waiting behind you? Does it even matter to you?" Then, of course, there's the post office. Have you visited the post office lately, by any chance? Have you stood in one of those long, long lines, or taken a ticket with a number and waited the remainder of the day for your number to be called? I've seen people's hair turn gray in post offices. I've seen them grow completely bald. I've seen crow's feet form in the corners of young people's eyes, and wrinkles appear on their faces as they age while standing on interminable lines, while two sluggish postal clerks service the assembled crowd. Yes, these postal clerks enjoy lifetime security. They don't have to work hard to try to service customers quickly and efficiently. They can just bumble along at their pace. Sometimes you'll see one of them leave his or her window and walk into the back of the post office and maybe be gone for 5 minutes before reappearing, while the waiting crowd grows steadily in numbers. And in those situations, I imagined calling out to all the poor fools standing in line with me, "Why do you stand for this wretched service? Why do you skulk here like a flock of sheep? Why do you let them get away with this? What's the matter with you? Aren't you infuriated by this treatment, this utter contempt?" I can't even enjoy watching football games anymore, what with the new breed of gloating, self-aggrandizing athletes, the halfback who spikes the ball into the end zone, raises both his arms to the roaring crowd with supreme arrogance, the way Mussolini did from his balcony, and performs a victory dance. It's not the way players were in the old days. Oh, these new players are talented athletes, no doubt about it, but they've added unseemly, ugly elements to the sport they participate in. And these professional athletes who pout, who go into terrible angry snits when earning only a few million dollars a year, still feel they're vastly underpaid. They want even more money because their lives are so hard. It's really tough to be a star athlete, to be treated with reverence by masses of people, to have beautiful women throw themselves at you, to earn hundreds of thousands of extra dollars by endorsing products, to perform in a game that people who have to work for a living play for the sheer pleasure of it at their own expense during the weekends. And they angrily demand more money than the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, than the CEOs of most major American corporations, than Nobel laureates, great writers, poets, philosophers, scientists earn. These miserable, stinking, arrogant, muscle-bound putzes who contribute nothing to nourishing in any meaningful way the society in which they are glorified, who cause ticket prices to soar so that you and I can't afford to go see games live anymore, who make it necessary for there to be constant commercial interruptions during the course of a contest in order to make up for their inflated salaries by encouraging you to consume every damn thing. What about these teenage dance shows? You see them on MTV and a lot of other channels, the ones where kids between the ages of 15 and 18, dressed in the most provocative outfits, girls wearing halters showing their bare midriffs, or in miniskirts and net stockings, or short shorts, or in jeans tightly sculpted around their pubises and buttocks, wearing makeup, looking like sultry, oversexed fashion whores, pump and grind and gyrate and simulate sexual intercourse with their young stud partners, for children at home to watch on TV. Yes, what a great message for America's children, a great standard of behavior to emulate. Let's all become brain-dead sex fashion dolls. Let's all be shallow, empty, stupid, ignorant, and worthless. I mean, what's the point of freedom if you don't let it debase you, if you don't let it wreak havoc with your genuine human values?
I must transform an injustice into an absurdity as a way of rethinking a situation. It's hard to get angry and laugh at the same time. I must add an ounce of love to everything I do. I must have a forgiving view of events and people. I must have an optimistic view of the world. I must believe that most people are doing the best that they can. Instead of blowing up when someone says something unkind, I should take a moment to rethink the situation. If I can tell myself that the person is probably having a bad day, I mean, we all have our bad days, then there's a good chance I won't get angry. I must understand that a conflict is not a win-lose situation. It's not important who wins or who's right. The goal is to solve a mutual problem through good communication. I must not expect to be treated with fairness and consideration at all times. I must take a few minutes to relax my whole body. I'll shake my shoulders, inhale and exhale deeply a few times, and clear my head of thoughts and concerns. I know what I'll do. The next time I find pressure mounting, I'll take 10 minutes and go for a brisk walk or climb some stairs. Then, when I return to the problem, I'll feel like a new person.
If I don't buy the farm, then what will happen when I blow my brains out? Another expression for death is the term gone fishing. Could it be that this image, this innocent metaphor, might represent my true destiny? I've died, and I've gone fishing. I'm sitting in a rowboat, an old straw hat on my head, a bamboo fishing pole extended over a tranquil lake, 2 or 3 inches of bilge water lapping at my feet. The green paint has long since flaked and chalked off the gunwales of the boat. I've got a cheese sandwich, a six-pack of Old Milwaukee, and I'm just drifting along, half listening to the water lapping against the side of the boat in an almost womb-like rhythm. It's late afternoon, autumn. The leaves are changing, and I'm smoking a corncob pipe with fragrant tobacco wafting heavenward. I can hear the wind in the trees blowing through the branches, fanning the embers of my pipe, causing flaming motes to detach themselves from the bowl. And I watch a tiny ember, now airborne, float away and disappear in the slanting brilliance of the late afternoon sunlight. The ember, still alive, falls on the leaf of an ancient maple tree. Then I notice that the slow leak has begun to fill the boat with green algae-covered water. I haven't bailed in 6 or 8 months, and I realize the boat is sinking. A moment later, I see a thread of smoke coming from the woods. There's a burning circle spreading outward on a single leaf, and when it reaches the edges, the leaf bursts into flame and curls inward. And then another leaf catches fire, and the tip of a branch, and another branch, and a single tree, and soon the woods are engulfed in flames like a great furnace, a roaring inferno. And I'm thinking, wait a second, I've gone fishing forever. This is not what I bargained for. And the next thing that happens is that I can hear the shrieking sirens of fire engines, then the rhythmic beating of helicopters, and see them overhead spraying foam over the forest. And then I hear the sounds of earth-moving machinery as crews advance through the woods, cutting roads, knocking down trees and digging fire trenches, radios crackling with orders. And then, finally, the fire is put out. And I'm discovered, hanging onto the side of the boat, the pipe still in my mouth. And they put 2 and 2 together and realize that I am the author of this terrible conflagration. And I'm arrested for arson, removed from the water, handcuffed, put in the back of a police cruiser, and driven to the county jail where the local DA, a young woman with insufferable garlic breath, interviews me at length. She's just come out of Risotto's, an Italian restaurant across the street from the jail, and she tells me that hundreds of homes, 2 schools, and a hospital have been destroyed, and that there are many burned and dead. An entire community has been wiped out. The economy of the state has been threatened, and a number of endangered species have been rendered extinct. And a huge crowd forms outside the jail. I can hear frenzied, angry voices, and I think, but I've gone fishing. How can this be? I'm a dead person. I went fishing. I was supposed to be in repose for eternity. And then I hear some rabble-rouser making a speech, his hoarse shrieks emanating from a bullhorn. The crowd cheers as someone throws a noose over a lamppost on the corner. And the sheriff comes in. He looks nervous. He's gray, pale, trembling. He says, "We're gonna have to try to sneak you out of here tonight." And I say, "But I'm dead." And he says, "If you think you're dead now, just wait. You don't know what dead is." How many of you have walked into the bathroom of a restaurant, a movie theater, an airport, or even the place where you work, opened the stall, and found the rim of the bowl splattered with urine, or the toilet left unflushed and befouled? How many of you have stood there revolted, turned your back, and gone to another stall? Or worse yet, no other stall available, have had to clean up the mess in order to do your business? You know, as far as their emissions are concerned, some people are illiterate. They're just animals masquerading as humans. And you never know who polluted the area either. They're never there. If you did, you could call out and say, "Come back here. How dare you leave this place in this condition? What kind of a person are you? Do you do this in your own home? If you do, you're even a bigger pig than I thought you were." Sometimes I like to imagine forming a hit squad. We'd station ourselves in restrooms and grab people who left unseemly, disgusting messes. Then we'd line them up against bathroom walls, execution style. And they'd think, "Well, I'll die, but it will soon be over." But instead of death, someone would come over to them with a bucket of human waste and dump it on their heads. And then we'd all march out. We'd call ourselves the Sanitation Corps. We'd be dressed in white. We'd wear gas masks. We'd be like subway cop versions of those germ warfare and anti-radiation people, scaled down for a restroom. And how often do you go to a movie theater anywhere in America, and your feet stick to the floor, and when the lights come on at the end of the film, all you can see is litter, giant buckets of popcorn spilled out over the chairs and the floors, bottles, cans, candy wrappers, straws, napkins, cellophane, cardboard, little pools of soda, and wrappers from things people brought in from McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken. And it's like the floor of a zoo. It's as if everybody there is an animal, after feeding time. And then there are the people who stand outside 7-Elevens, supermarkets, and banks and hit you up for money. What do you do about them? First, they impose on all of us a complex of emotions, anger, guilt, and fear. There's certainly something threatening and aggressive about many of these people, so that the line between begging and mugging has almost disappeared. They give you a story, something happened, they need the money. But there's an edge to their voices, an angry, disturbed edge that suggests that if you don't give them something, something bad might happen to you too. They might kill you. Yes, the world isn't safe anymore.
I must transform an injustice into an absurdity as a way of rethinking a situation. It's hard to get angry and laugh at the same time. I must add an ounce of love to everything I do. I must have a forgiving view of events and people. I must have an optimistic view of the world. I must believe that most people are doing the best that they can. Instead of blowing up when someone says something unkind, I should take a moment to rethink the situation. If I can tell myself that the person is probably having a bad day, I mean, we all have our bad days, then there's a good chance I won't get angry. I must understand that a conflict is not a win-lose situation. It's not important who wins or who's right. The goal is to solve a mutual problem through good communication. I must not expect to be treated with fairness and consideration at all times. I must take a few minutes to relax my whole body. I'll shake my shoulders, inhale and exhale deeply a few times, and clear my head of thoughts and concerns. I know what I'll do. The next time I find pressure mounting, I'll take 10 minutes and go for a brisk walk or climb some stairs. Then, when I return to the problem, I'll feel like a new person.
So that was a great example of Mr. Joe Frank. He's one of the characters that we're going to listen to on this show. Again, another late night raconteur. So what we're going to do now is we're going to move to the Italian section of the show. We're going to let Mr. Paolo Conte sing to us about sort of the virtues of lemon ice. And then we're going to get a great recipe for pasta vizzul. And then after that, we're going to get tanned by the moon. Good stuff coming up here.
Gelato al limone, gelato al limone. Sprofondati in fondo a una città. Un gelato al limone, è vero limone, ti piace? Mentre un'altra estate se ne va. Libertà e berline colorate. Ecco quello che io ti darò. E la sensualità delle vite disperate. Ecco il dono che io ti farò. Donna che stai entrando nella mia vita, con una valigia di perplessità. Ah, non aver paura che sia già finito. Ancora tante cose quest'uomo ti darà. E gelato al limone, gelato al limone, gelato al limone. Sprofondati in fondo a una città. Un gelato al limone, gelato al limone, gelato al limone. Mentre un'altra estate passerà. ti offro una doccia e bagni di ur. Che sono degli abissi di tiepidità. Dove come oceani notturni rimbombano le voci della tua città. E ti offro la luna del pomeriggio per il sogno arabo che ami tu. E una stretta forte dalla mia mano per te donna che non mi scappi più. E un gelato al limone, gelato al limone, gelato al limone. L'intelligenza degli elettricisti, così almeno un po' di luce avrà la nostra stanza negli alberghi tristi, dove la notte calda ci scioglierà. Come gelato al limone, gelato al limone, gelato al limone. Come un gelato al limone, gelato al limone, gelato al limone. Come un gelato al limone, gelato al limone, gelato al limone. Come un gelato.
Jersey, and I'd like to share a recipe that I got from my sister Karen Zokel for escarole and beans. This is a simple recipe. You're going to need one pot on the stove and about one tablespoon of olive oil. You're going to add a lot of chopped garlic, and you don't want the garlic to get too brown. It should be soft and just turning brown. Once that happens, you're going to add 2 cans of chicken broth, collagen or whatever brand you prefer, 1 can of cannelloni beans. First drain and wash the beans and then add them to the mixture. You're then going to add 1 can of diced tomatoes, preferably with no oregano or anything else, just plain diced tomatoes. You want to clean and chop your escarole. You'll add that to the pot, and then you're going to add a lot of salt and a little pepper, a lot of salt. Bring that mixture to a boil, and then simmer it for about 25 minutes. The escarole should be somewhat of a spinach type consistency, very, very loose. You can serve that over pasta or just by itself, but one final touch is a must. You must top it with Parmesan cheese. More the better. And you can also serve it with bread, Italian bread, of course. Enjoy!
Abbronzate tutte chiazze, pelli rosse un po' paonazze, son le ragazze che prendono il sol. Ma ce n'è una che prende la luna, tintarella di luna, tintarella color
la bella tra le belle. E se c'è la luna piena, tu diventi candida. Tin tin tin, raggi di luna, tin tin tin, baciano te al mondo nessuna è candida come te, tintarella di luna.
Well, it must officially be summer if we're going to get tanned by the moon. While I'm sitting here in the studio here in beautiful Main Street, Catskill, there are fireworks going on around me. Celebrate summer and all it has to offer. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more tune.
Every year when summer comes around, you stretch a banner across a main street in town, and you can feel something happening in the air. Well, from Carol's house up on Telegraph Hill, you can see the lights going up out in the soldiers' field, getting ready for the county fair. County fair, county fair, everybody in town will be there, so come on. Here we're going down there. Daddy, one of them stuffed bears, baby, down
Thank you for listening, everybody, and keep listening to